You are listening to part two of the Jeff Jones Locker Room Access podcast. And this episode, we actually talk about Jeff Jones's coaching career from assistant, how he found out about becoming the head coach, how he got the job, all of that, which is super fascinating. And then we move on to what it was like coaching and recruiting and getting McDonald's All-Americans. And he talks a lot about his philosophies as a coach. And also, interestingly, the players we could have gotten and the ones that got away in terms of Melvin Whitaker and Courtney Alexander and the off-the-court issues. It's the first time I personally heard him talk about that. So I thought that part was really cool. And this is three parts in total. So part one was mostly, Jeff Jones's early recruitment to UVA in his playing days. And then two will be most of the coaching stuff. And then in part three, we talk about after UVA, and then we do our photo series, as well as we do an extended Mount Rushmore for Jeff Jones. So that'll come tomorrow. So I wouldn't say you have to listen to part one to understand what's going on in part two, but it definitely helped. Stay tuned by subscribing on Spotify. We have the YouTube series that we post the photo series on. Just search Locker Room Access. We're on Apple Podcasts. We just added Stitcher. If there are any other podcast networks, definitely hit us up. Go on a forum, Instagram, Twitter, ask away. We'll try to accommodate as best we can. We also have a couple of unique items in the store. One is the White Spot shirt. It's one to help support small businesses in Charlottesville, and White Spot obviously being an iconic restaurant that so many people adore, especially back in the day. I think if you listen to Junior Burrow's podcast, he talks about it. But what we do there is all the profits, we're actually ordering White Spot, delivering it to the UVA hospital for the workers, especially. We're going to try to do the late night shift, and the first batch is coming here very soon. We also have a Unity Tee. Check that one out. It's actually all of the guys kneeling on a black tee. It's a photo print. It's obviously, with everything that's going on in the world today, that one feels very necessary. And all of that, the profits from that one are actually going to go to the Ridley Scholarship Fund, and he is the first actual African-American to attend a Southern university. So take a look at it. It's on our site. It's called the Unity T, the Ridley Scholarship Fund. Check it out and enjoy part two.
So after you finish your time at UVA, what's next for you?
Well, I graduated and it was on a Sunday. By Monday morning, I had received five job offers. Realized that I did not want to work for a living. I wanted to keep playing as long as I could. While I was grateful for those job offers from the folks in Charlottesville, there was no way that was going to be, my future. I ended up being drafted by the Indiana Pacers, and played with them out in the LA Summer League. I should have known they had 13 guaranteed contracts on the roster anyway, with only 12 spots. So, that just the math didn't work out there. When they let me go, I signed with Golden State as a free agent and went in and had a great preseason and a great camp. Had basically made the team. And then I sprained my ankle pretty badly. So I was laid up for a couple weeks. During that interim time, they needed to find people. They ended up signing their number one draft pick, Lester Connor. But at the time, I still would have had a spot But then they signed Michael Ray Richardson. The handwriting was on the wall. So when I came off injured reserve, you know, I was gone. And, you know, they encouraged me to, you know, stay with it or whatever. But I knew that, you know, that my playing career was done. I had an offer to go to Spain. Back then, that wasn't nearly as attractive an offer as it might be. It wasn't the norm. Coach Holland had saved me a spot on the coaching staff. So that was my next step, and I went back and you know, was there for another 16 years.
How about your time in the brief time playing in the against NBA guys? Was it a shock? Were you like, I can play with these guys, whatever, I've seen it all?
I think both. I mean, I was confident in my ability to play. You know, I was never going to be an all-star or anything like that, but I, you know, and you got to remember, back then there were a lot fewer teams.
Right.
You know, I wish, you know, that there were as many teams then as there are now. You know, right. I could have maybe gotten some of that NBA money. Yeah, back then, I mean, I can remember in a preseason game, two-on-one fast break, Kareem and Magic coming right at me.
Right.
Thinking, you know, what the hell am I going to do here? Kareem threw a behind-the-back pass out of bounds. So that you know, hey.
Good job. Good job, JJ.
I can remember guarding Magic Johnson in the low post, and the ball was out on the wing, and I was behind him, and he was so daggone big, I couldn't see around him. People don't understand. The guy's huge. He's not just 6'8". He was like 250 or whatever. I mean,
right.
I could not see around him. I remember guarding Walter Davis up in Portland, and he made a move, and he left me behind. And then all of a sudden, he made a second move. He didn't need the second move. He made the second move, and I was perfectly positioned, and I blocked his shot. I was thinking,
he outmoved himself.
Good defense there.
He's like, you're supposed to be over here.
Yeah, but it, you know, it was great getting at least getting a chance to live my dream of playing in the NBA. But you know, that just wasn't. I was married at the time. I had a great situation back in Virginia waiting for me. There was no way I was going to just kind of bounce around and wait till the next year to you know, to try to give it another shot.
We talk about that all the time too. But in the old ACC, your time and then my time, there's 4 to 7 NBA guys on the court every game, right? You're talking about how competitive you're talking about
Well,
Al Wood, Jim.
Yeah, but again, Doug, you got to think there's 4 to 7 guys in the NBA. With what, half as many NBA teams now?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
As now, so I mean, think about that. That, you know, the level of play, just, you know, and guys were there as juniors and seniors.
Right.
So it is different, and I'm not going to get in an argument about which is better or which is, you know, worse. That's irrelevant. Right. But I do think it was a special time in the ACC for sure.
So you're basically saying I would have had a shot at the NBA if I graduated in this era, not in my era.
Well, I definitely, I mean, without a doubt, if you were, you know, quicker and taller.
And shot it better and dribbled and played better defense.
Maybe not white. It's funny because JJ made me think when he got sold, he sold them wrong when he had his visit. I felt the same way because I think everybody was expecting a 6'1" black point guard named Doug Smith out of Fayetteville, Tennessee. Rick Carlisle, hey, was like, hey, man, sorry I didn't talk to you all day, but I didn't know who you were. Havlicek going through every ethnicity. He's like, you have to be this. No, you have to be this. I'm like, no.
Well, hey, Doug, the last time when – was it when you were down here? When you had the big full beard?
I had a beard, a little bit more.
Well, you definitely could have been Russian with the bald head and the beard. I mean, you right. Could have been Igor. Hey, am I allowed – and I don't know how long we're going, but am I allowed to tell the story of your visit?
Yes, oh, yeah, please.
We were going to get to that, but if you want to tell it now, tell it now.
Well, I want to make sure because I couldn't believe I was driving the car, and Doug and Dave Odom, one of the other assistant coaches, were in the car, and we were just doing a driving tour of grounds, and we were coming down in front of the library, the Alderman Library. We were going by the black bus stop right there, and Dave Odom had said, "Yeah, yeah," and he points at the rotunda, and says, "Yeah, that's where we eat pregame meals." And I about wrecked. I mean, I was like, "What?" I mean, Odom was just saying it didn't matter. I mean, he was just making stuff up on the fly.
I have no idea what that building is anyway. I'm like, "Why would you have pregame meals there?"
I'm
like, "Oh, that sounds great, coach."
But, I mean, the other thing, I mean. You know, you didn't know what the rotunda was. You didn't know what a library was either.
No, actually, I'm not sure I did until about my third year as well. You had us in the study hall, so.
So what was the recruiting visit and or the recruiting scouting page report for Dougie Fresh when you guys were deciding?
It's like when you need a point guard and you're in desperation mode. And
I mean, it was late, and we needed a point guard.
What month are we talking about? Okay.
I was late. March.
And we needed a point guard, a backup point guard, because Crotty was on the team, right, Doug?
Yep. Crotty was going to be a junior.
So. We got word that there was a kid down in Tennessee. He was, you know, and smart and all this stuff. And so I went down and watched, and you know, we brought pretty, you know, we were hoping to kind of get. I want to say, Doug, you were just on grounds briefly, and didn't we leave to play a game?
You guys were getting ready to go play Michigan.
Yeah.
I saw you got an NCAA tournament, Providence, Middle Tennessee State, and then you beat Oklahoma, and then you guys are getting ready for that. So it was the basketball aspect of my visit was phenomenal.
Yeah.
But the rest of it, I was like, these guys are might be losers though. you guys had bigger things to do, which I get. I was also, Marky, I was stringing along everybody. So I was late, but I was like, yeah, I'll get back to you. You know, I got an offer here. I'm gonna do my visits, all that stuff. So
right. And then UVA comes on the scene.
The offer.
Right, exactly. You just knew UVA, Kentucky, and Kansas were coming.
I was waiting for Coach Smith, but he got Kenny Harris, so that didn't happen. No, I couldn't have worked out better. And as JJ knows, my mentor growing up, Raymond W. Fraley, I didn't have a choice in my decision when I was trying to go to Texas A&M or Arkansas State. Jonesboro. He was like, no, Douglas. No. But it's funny, as Jeff Jones.
Think about this. If you had gone to Arkansas State, where would you be now? You wouldn't be in the Big Apple.
I'd have a 7,000 square foot house in the middle of nowhere in Arkansas. Probably 7,000.
For like $100,000.
And just ecstatic about like Stew Piggy or whatever it is all day. But I remember JJ came to see me and thinking about him as a coach, and I only knew him as a coach. I followed him and all those guys as basketball players when I was young. But he came and watched my game, one of the games, whatever. And I don't know if you realize this, but he's like, you know, Doug, before he started calling me Fresh, he's like, you know, you hit that three, and you came down again, you were open for it, and you didn't shoot it again. He's like, you got to shoot that thing. And he always used to, he's such a coach. And when I got on grounds and we're doing our first practice, he's like, hey guys, who am I? It might have been my visit. And he takes the ball, somebody throws the ball out of bounds, he takes one dribble and passes it up the sideline, making so we had that secondary fast break. And JJ's in there scouting, kind of like he's sort of making fun of me, letting me know what's to come, I think.
Now what was your impression on those visits of JJ?
Of JJ? I mean It's when you're 18, somebody who's 25 seems old as shit. But you realize now that we're like kind of the same thing. He was obviously the guy in practice when I was actually paying attention, not like trying to drink Gatorade or whatever on the sideline. you know, he was definitely the player's development guy, I felt like, because he, when I got to school and the guys didn't play as much their first or second year or whatever, JJ played with us. And then you realize not only is he a player's development coach, but he's a competitive motherfucker. Like, we're doing pickup games to win. And you talk about, like, you know, JJ's 6'4", and now he's a man, a grown, you know, 25-year-old, not an 18-year-old 180. And athletic, way more athletic than people think, especially to people like me. But you remember those games, JJ? We'd have heated games, and I'd get pissed off. You'd get pissed off, probably. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that was I still loved playing. You know, that was great. And I refuse. You remember DW always would play in those noontime games, you know, and he would play, you know, against Bruce Arena, obviously a big soccer name. He would play against Gino Auriemma. Gino was a women's assistant coach at the time. And you know, some of the football assistant coaches. At that time, I refused. I guess I was too arrogant or cocky. There's no way I would lower myself to play with those guys. I still wanted to play with the real players. But right. You were on the team. Yeah, you were on the team when my pickup career came to an end.
Yep.
I was playing against Bernie Floriani and Dirk Kastra. Dennis and I were playing them and beating their ass. And I blew out my knee. Last time I ever played.
As I saw it happen. I think when I was there, you were still dunking too. Had to be, right?
Probably.
Yeah, you were still dunking when I was. But then I saw the knee thing happen in slow motion.
That was when Yuri Barnes walked by, and said, "Listen to Coach."
Makes sense.
I never read that.
Didn't miss a day though. I remember you coming in the next day on the damn crutches, on the sidelines.
Yeah.
Coach, 8 seasons as an assistant coach. What were the most valuable lessons you learned, and how much were you prepared going into that job because of your relationship with your dad and your understanding of the game while you got better and improved as a player?
You know, my dad and I, oddly enough, never really had lots of conversations about coaching. You know, it was more about the game, and he kind of shaped my approach to the game. But the coaching part of it, I think, came more from, you know, Coach Holland, you know, maybe something from Jim Lahren and Craig Littlepage as assistant coaches. And then once I got into it, Dave Odom was on the staff. And Dave Odom was an unbelievable resource for you know, and Lahren Egan was on the staff, and he was, you know, obviously a great coach, and but Odom was the one that I talked to, you know, about the profession. It was just a great learning experience, and I, you know, I loved it. I didn't get to recruit the first couple years. That back then there was only 2 coaches, I listened. I sat in on all the meetings and listened to them talk about, you know, how to recruit and the ways to go about things. And so I thought once I made that move when Lahren Egan went to Bowling Green and I moved up a chair, you know, I thought with Dave Odom's mentorship and advice, I thought I knew, you know, what to do on the recruiting trail. So it was a great experience. And, you know, I think my whole thing is if you're around good people, you're around smart people, you're around successful people, if you pay attention, you know, you're going to pick something up very, very positive.
And clearly you're one of the top recruiters to pull Doug Smith.
Doug Smith, that might go down as you know, my all-time signee. You know,
right. That's right. Found that gem. Yeah. Rough.
So what are you thinking when Holland's about to depart and leave coaching?
Well, you know, it was interesting because it was a surprise to all of us. He said, come on, let's go running one day. That fall, August, whenever it was. And we went running, and that's when he told me. And I was the first person on the staff that he told. You know, it kind of caught us all by surprise. It left Craig Littlepage and I in a little bit of a crazy situation, because how do you recruit and not know who the head coach is going to be?
Right.
You know, we were able to sign what I think were two pretty good players under any circumstances, but certainly, you know, not knowing who the coach was going to be, Derek Johnson and Corey Stewart. Now, neither one of them, you know, ended up playing much. Corey transferred, and Derek didn't play and eventually left. But that was a that was an interesting time, to say the least.
And then we had Cornell. Cornell was in that group, right? Because
that was the first time I signed Cornell. he had to go to Fork Union to get his SAT score up.
Right. And then he was in that class.
Yeah.
That's right.
And then did Holland recommend you for the position?
It's complicated. Coach Holland basically thought that, you know, that I would be the person, but thought that if one or the other of Craig Littlepage or I were going to get the job, that Page may have a better chance, because he had head coaching experience and being an African American. So, you know, we talked about that, and he said that's the way we're going to move forward. And so, you know, I just kind of accepted that. That didn't last very long. That wasn't the way I think a lot of people, you know, saw it. And I'm not sure that either one of us was initially was a serious candidate for the job. But as things progressed, you know, I know Pete Gillen was on the radar. They never got together. I don't know if Pete, I think if I remember correctly, maybe the AD at Pete's school, wherever he was, Xavier, maybe didn't give permission for Virginia to talk to him. I know Mike Montgomery came in on an interview, when I was, it was during the Final Four, and I was maybe Denver. I'm not sure. At the Final Four, and I get a call, you need to come back immediately. And I came back, and Mike Montgomery was there, and basically he told me, he gave me an assignment. And, you know, he wanted the names of every player 6'10 or bigger if they had a 3.0 GPA in the country. I just assumed that he had been offered the job. That wasn't the case, and he left and ended up getting a big raise at Stanford. Rick Barnes came in, and I think Rick Barnes was probably the guy. They offered him the job. I can still remember sitting around the office the day that Rick Barnes came in for his interview. And we were all trying to figure out what the heck it was that we were going to do with our lives. The job was offered to Rick Barnes. He accepted it. Once he got back, Dave Gavitt, I guess, talked him out of it. I didn't know that, though. I actually left the office, went to Richmond. I didn't know what else to do, so I just did what I normally would have been doing. I went to Richmond and was at an AAU practice, sitting there watching I forget who it was, but I was watching an AAU practice, and Dick Tarrant, the coach at Richmond at the time, walked in and said, yeah, did you hear about Rick Barnes? And I said, yeah, you know, he took the job. He said, no, 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 no. He turned it down. And I guess while I had been in the gym, you know, word had gotten out that after accepting it, he called back and turned it down. So I immediately left, and I drove home and got home. And back then, you know, you had the voice machines, the message machines. I had so many messages. I had over 30. I mean, it just went on and on. So I didn't know what the heck was going on. The next day, I spoke with Jim Copeland, the AD, and interviewed with him. A couple days later, I interviewed with him again. Didn't really know what was going on. We had our banquet, and as I walk into the banquet, I still had no idea. I walk into the banquet, and he's kind of there. Doug, you'll remember in University Hall where the ticket office was in front.
Yep.
In the main entrance. Yeah. I was walking in there, and he kind of walks over and just whispers and just says, "You still interested in the job?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Congratulations, but you can't tell anybody." So I'm sitting there the entire banquet about to explode. I didn't even tell my wife. And sitting there, and then, you know, when the banquet ended, we were driving home, and I said, "Well, I got the job." And she's like, "What do you mean?" And I said, "He offered me the job before the banquet, but we can't say anything until they announce it." So it was a crazy time the entire year, and certainly that last couple weeks it ended up great for me. But, you know, a lot of uncertainty and not really, you know, knowing what was going to happen for the future.
Did Coach Holland know before you, or no? Was he Mr. Copeland was just done with him?
Coach Holland and Jim Copeland weren't on great terms by that point. Yep. So
that's what I figured.
What was your immediate plan?
What's that?
What was your immediate plan after being named head coach?
I think, you know, getting a staff together, there was no real reason to change a whole lot. We had a very good team coming back. You know, there was no need to change the offense or change the defense. You know, it was just to kind of keep things rolling, I think. And then once we got our staff together, and that took a little bit of time, but once we got our staff together, whatever new stuff came up, it was focused on recruiting and trying to be a lot more aggressive on the recruiting trail and doing things in that way, maybe differently than had ever been done at Virginia.
Yeah. Right. Well, you recruited some really, really good players.
Yeah, the translation. They're trying to get a McDonald's All-American point guard, Mark. That's what they were trying to do. Well, I say we had a meeting. It had to be right after the banquet. I mean, that week, I assume, when you had us in. And I'll tell you, our side as players, I can't, again, like, you don't talk for everybody. I don't either. I mean, I think we were relieved and happy because we didn't know shit about Rick Barnes. And we had, you know, John Crotty, Matt Blunden, Dirk Koetstra, Kenny Turner. As to me, they were like grown men and real leaders that – they didn't need a new guy to come in and revamp the whole thing. So I think us as players, and I've said it before on Crotty's podcast, that I think we were relieved and we wanted to stay the same, at least from that team. And it was a close team, our standpoint. Yeah. You know, JJ came in, he did the first thing. I think the first question Dirk Koetstra said, he's like, can I ask a question? He's like, sure. He's like, do we have to call you Coach Jones now? And he's like, no, I'm still JJ. Don't call me Coach Jones. That changed when Junior Burroughs needed to call somebody Coach Junior Burroughs.
Yeah. Do you remember your first recruiting class?
I mean, I think that first recruiting class was Corey Alexander, Jason Williford, Uri Barnes, Chris Alexander, and Junior Burroughs. I take that back. That was the next year. After I got hired, I immediately went to Fork Union and re-signed Cornell Parker, who had signed with us, committed to us the year before, but went to get his SAT score up. So Cornell was my first recruit as a head coach, but my first recruiting class as a head coach was those guys, which was ranked I think second in the country behind the Michigan's Fab Five.
Still probably goes down as one of the best classes in Virginia history, I'd say. Pretty cool.
Yeah, and you know the funny thing is we probably I don't know how it would have shaken out, but there were a couple. We had another scholarship, and there were a couple guys. You know, Andrew DeClerc was one that essentially we kind of backed off, but we had a really good end with, and I was afraid. You know, I didn't want to over recruit, which you know I learned much later to not worry about over recruiting. You know, that kind of stuff works its way out. But you know, we could have added to that, I think, but you know, chose not to, which you know may have been a mistake. I don't know.
Yeah. 40. That's great. That's great of a kid and family, Andrew DeClerc. I think you remember them. We played them at Florida the next year. Great kid, great. He was the most boring guy to what is it called when I to host him on his visit.
Yeah,
he made me go to the architecture school for like 2 hours one day. I'm like, dude, Big Red's got a party going on at Astry right now. Let's go. Tell your mom and dad, go somewhere. Let's go.
Well, I also remember that some of you guys got mad. It didn't really bother me that much. It did bother Dennis Wolf. During practice, Andrew DeClerc fell asleep on the bleachers in University Hall, and some of you guys were mad. I was like, how does that affect anything? You know,
he laid down the bleachers. He did not up. I remember that. He did. He's probably so damn bored from going to the architecture school. That's probably what happened. Nah, he's a great player though. He's a really good dude. Good family.
4 20-win seasons, which is awesome. One of the youngest coaches ever at UVA and around the country, head coaches. What were your favorite years there at UVA?
Wow. You know, I think that team when Junior, Corey, and all them, you know, I don't know that the year was my favorite, but that team was probably my favorite. I mean, that was kind of a culmination. Those guys were fourth year, you know, we'd had success to that point. We were a game short of the Final Four. You know, we did go through some adversity with Corey breaking his foot the second time, and you know, and the little known fact is that Corey could have actually played in that game against Arkansas.
Oh, wow.
He had been practicing with us, you know, so he was fully cleared to, you know, physical activity. But I didn't even ask him. I didn't want to take that risk. And, you know, if this is the first time that people have heard this, they might be pissed off. But there was no way. You know, I don't know what I would have done if he had come to me, but there was no way that I was going to ask somebody that had broken their foot twice, you know, to come out. I mean, he sacrificed a lot for the program with that, you know, having broken his foot twice. But you know, it does every once in a while cross my mind, like, you know, could we have actually beaten Arkansas if Corey had played 12 minutes,
right.
You know, cause Harold was, I mean, they wore his ass down the 40 minutes of hell. They wore him down. And Jamal did a solid job, but you know, to have somebody backing up the caliber of Corey, you know, what difference could that have made? I don't know.
If it was me, I guarantee you would have made me play. You wouldn't have asked if I wanted to play.
Well, it's different for you. You weren't going to the NBA, dude. That would have been the highlight. You would have been a god.
I get it. I didn't know Corey could have played.
Now, well, he was practicing every day in practice. I don't know if you remember that. But Doug, do you remember when you had appendicitis?
Of course.
They went in and they did the arthroscopic appendectomy, and you played like 2 days later.
Yep, I played Notre Dame. I missed Georgia Tech, and then Saturday or Sunday, Notre Dame. 7 points, by the way, that game, JJ. I figured my appendix was out. Like, what can I hurt now? I don't have an appendix anymore.
Yeah.
So Jay Willie's, his soft kids that play at Virginia now, Justin Anderson and London Prentice, great guys. They both had their appendix out, and they took like 2 weeks. So I still hold one of my bizarre Virginia basketball records.
Come back.
Come back from an appendicitis of three people pool. Yeah, man, I did not know Corey could have played. Corey never would have held that against you, though. Anything to do. So you wash your hands of him there.
That 94-95 team is, no one's going to argue that that wasn't one of the best teams ever at UVA. But it had its challenges, right? I mean, you had to sort of, especially at a young age, had to manage so many different personalities. Was that team one of the more difficult teams to coach, managing the personalities?
Oh, no, definitely not. That was an easy team. You know, the team my first year with Crotty and Stiff and Blunden, that was a challenge because, again, they were older, the really strong personalities. That was tougher. That 94, 95, those guys were so close, and good. I didn't have to, like, a lot of the stuff off the court, the personalities and stuff, they took care of it. You know, I learned after the fact, I mean, after they had graduated, you know, about a team meeting that they had, and basically Corey was talking and Jason Wilford stood up and threatened to kick his ass and told him to be quiet. You know, and so those guys, and they're all tight. I mean, you know, there's yeah. They're like brothers, but you know, I learned about that afterwards. So anything, any kind of beef or whatever, they squashed it. And it was all about, you know, winning basketball games. So I would say that was actually, you know, an easy win. That doesn't mean I didn't get frustrated at Junior Burrow and all his nonsense. But that's just Junior. That's who Junior is. There's nothing malicious or really bad. He's still, I don't know how old he is now, but he's just goofy. But he's lovable goofy.
Yeah.
I was going to bring it back to a year prior. We talked to Junior about this. I think it was Stiff's fourth year, and that selection Sunday, you guys were in Charlotte. Like, I remember watching that as a kid and thinking, what? They forgot Virginia. What happened? I just was curious. What do you remember about that? And then you guys obviously going on to win the IIT, but like selection Sunday itself, what do you remember about that?
I just remember, you know, being nervous going into it. I mean, we just didn't have enough wins. I mean, ultimately, that's what it was. Mm-hmm. Were we good enough? You're damn right we were. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no question. But we just didn't have enough wins. And, you know, it hurt. And I you know, I went through initially, I think I was angry. And then I just felt badly for the team. But by the time it came around, you know, and they wanted to know about IIT. I was all in, and we obviously had a young group. We had a mix. Obviously, Stith and Oliver were fourth years, but you know that we had that freshman group, and the NIT was a great opportunity for us. And I think just like, and you can go back to when I was playing in what 79-80. Right. With Ralph, and we had a good team, and you know, the regular season didn't go the way we wanted. We used that NIT forum as a springboard. The team with you know, Bryant's senior year, they did the same thing. It was an opportunity for Bryant and Anthony to go out on a positive note, but it was also an opportunity for you know, that group of young guys, Junior and Corey and Jason and Yuri and Chris. and everybody else to kind of springboard into that next year.
Yep. So we've had Junior on the podcast. We had Jason Williford. We've spoken with a lot. And Junior and Jason Willie both talk about him getting kicked out of practice several times. Does that ring a bell?
Jason. Junior never got kicked out of practice that I can remember. Jason was the one that, you know, Junior talked all the time, but Junior didn't talk back. Jason Williford would talk back. He'd be a smart aleck. He'd do something. And, you know, and I'd just say, you know, get out.
You talked about Jason telling Corey to shut up before he beats his ass. I've heard Jason say that about 20 times. Have we ever seen Jason scrap? Have you ever seen the follow through in Jason's talking?
I don't know that anybody's ever stood up to him, so I don't know.
That's a good point. Remember the practice? Something happened his first year, and he just punted the basketball into the last row of U-Haul. Just walked off. We're like, okay, good kicker.
When Curtis Staples was first year, so whatever year that was, Jason Williford and Kurt, because I have no idea what it was about, but I booted them both. They go into the locker room in University Hall. They go back there, and Jason tells the story great. It's Kurt's crying. It's like, oh, my God, are they going to call my parents? What are we going to do, Jay? And Jason was all calm. I mean, he'd done this before. And they're in there. He said, look, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a shower. We're going to get in the hot tub. Then we're going to go get something to eat. Then we'll apologize to Coach Jones. Everything will be fine. Just relax. So he had it planned out. He knew exactly what was going on. They were in there while the rest of the team was out there, you know, practicing and going on. They went. They took a hot tub and a shower and went and got something to eat. You know, but Jason was the old hand, and he was teaching Curtis Staples the ropes. But Curtis was crying and was worried that we were going to call his parents.
Junior Burrow was a surprise guest on the Jay Willie show. We do a show with Jay Willie that airs every Monday night, and he tells a story about one of the coaches kicking him out of practice because he put his hair in little braids. And says, before Jeff Jones comes out here, you better get your ass out and change your hairstyle. Do you remember that at all?
I don't. Okay. I don't.
JJ learns something new about us about every year when we get back together with him at his house. There's always a new story. One day we'll be grown up enough to tell him everything, you know? But I say, like, we talk about how it's different now, and you talk about the players. You know, Mark, I always mess with Tyrone Jerome and all those guys. They won the national championship. They come to the hotel, and they go to the third floor, and they're, you know, we're down there partying, all of us. And I'm like, Jason, if that was us, we would have thrown our luggage into, like, somebody, just take it, and we would be right there in the mix, and our coach, JJ, would be 100% for it. I know it's different now, and I know cell phones, et cetera, but you said you didn't – the 95 team was easy. Like, the one thing that we all kind of made happen, but it obviously comes from the head coach, Coach Holland, you guys let us be men, right? As long as we took care of our shit. We didn't have rules. We didn't have curfews. You know, we had go to class rule, get your grades rule, go to practice. But you guys, like, you know, appreciated and let us have that experience at Virginia and kind of police ourselves. And thank goodness Junior had guys like Brian Stith and myself and everybody.
Well, he was shooting okay. Away. I do have to say this, Doug. We were talking about some of the stories that I've heard after you've graduated. Had I known those stories then, you would have had more curfews.
That makes sense. Maybe I read it wrong. I went a little over the top on it.
No, I would not to get all philosophical, but I think, you know, in any relationship you want to be able to trust, and part of our job as coaches is obviously from a basketball standpoint, you know, trying to help you maximize, you know, that part of yourself and academically, but also, you know, as a human being and as a man. And I think if we do everything for you, if for 4 years, right, you know, I held your hand, figuratively speaking, and told you when to eat, when to sleep, when to study, when to play basketball, when to, you know, do whatever, you know, you'd graduate, you know, you'd have a diploma, but I don't think that you'd have a true college education. And I definitely don't think that we would have developed you as a person. And I think people have to have, until they prove that they can't handle it, you know, I think they've got to have some responsibility and have some freedom. And make some decisions on their own, even if sometimes they fail, and we can, you know, we can be there as a safety net and try to, you know, get people back up on that path. But, you know, I think it's important. And it, part of that is, I think, stems from the way Coach Holland treated us. You know, we don't want it to be like prison, and we do want to develop men. And you know, that's a big part of it. And obviously, you know, there was stuff that went on, but I'm very, very proud of who you guys have become as men, as fathers, as husbands. So I do think there is a method to the madness, and you know, I think of you guys, and you know, I'm very, very proud of our relationship and our association.
Appreciate it. That's it. And the bigger testament is how close we all still are, I think. You know, like Junior and Brian, all those guys, we're family ever since then. And there's not a lot of programs around the country that have that, you know, 20 years later.
Yeah, I think it's funny when people throw around the word or the term family, you know, they just use it all the time. And, you know, I think oftentimes the more you talk about it, or if you put family, you know, on the butt of your practice shorts or stuff like that, I think that cheapens it. But I do think that the relationship that you guys have, that you allow Dennis and I and Brian Ellerby and, you know, and TP and, you know, all of that group, the relationship that you guys allow us to have, I think it's something special. I don't think it's unique. I think there's probably other places that have something similar.
Sure.
But not a lot. It's certainly not the majority. And we're not throwing out, you know, the brotherhood and crap like that. There, you know, labels, again, I think labels like that, you know, hashtag this or hashtag that cheapens it. And I'm, again, I'm very appreciative of what we all, you know, still have.
Same.
Very successful first 5 years at UVA coaching. What was the difference between after that 94-95 season and your last 3 years? Although you did have a really good 96-97 season, winning 18 games as well.
You know, I think we had some off-court incidents that affected the personnel and the team. I think it's as simple as that. We had some really positive recruiting results that we never were able to see materialize because of the off-the-court stuff. And ultimately, we just weren't good enough on the court. Our margin of error, even in that 96-97, when we went to the NCAA tournament, even that year, you know, we had Curtis and Norman, you know, Willie Dersh, I think, was a freshman that year. Was he a freshman that year? You know, we just didn't have enough. You know, we had some good pieces, but as Doug alluded to earlier, if you're gonna compete in the ACC, you better have, you know, good players, but you better have a bunch of them too.
Right.
You know, we just our margin of error was too slim.
Yeah. Right. I mean, because you were still landing at that time top players. Willie Dirch was a McDonald's All-American. Jamal Kurt coming Norm, in yeah. was really good. Norm, Curtis Staples, still had top guys. But it seemed like some of the off-court issues, as you mentioned, with Melvin Whitaker.
Melvin Whitaker.
Yeah, Courtney Alexander and T-Dubs. Who were the other ones?
Daryl Presley. I think there was Scott Johnson. Those were fairly minor. I think the Melvin Whitaker one was pretty bad, to my
recollection. Melvin Whitaker was the toughest one. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you lose a guy like Courtney Alexander, who's a top five player in the country. I mean, he was ridiculous. Right, whatever. I don't know him. I met him one time. But he was an absurd. So you're considering that for your roster, and that's gone. So for sure, a big deal.
Were those guys when you were recruiting them? Were there questions on that stuff? And you're like, you know what? Let's take a risk and see if we can manage it. Or did you not? Those blindsided you completely?
Yeah, absolutely not. Melvin Whitaker was a good kid, and we beat North Carolina to get him. Courtney, there was never any question from a character standpoint or anything like that with Courtney. I mean, he was different, but nothing like that. And, those things happened, and I hope, both of those guys, all of those guys have been able to, get back on track and have productive lives and everything. It's unfortunate, but those were things that took place that I think didn't just impact them. It impacted our program and everyone involved with it.
Yeah. So in total, you spent about 20 years at UVA as a player and a coach.
Yep.
Right. And then you part ways and you go on to the next part of your career. What was it like moving on from Charlottesville?
That was the end of part two. We have part three coming up tomorrow. And if you stuck through this much, you might as well tune into this full 3-hour episode. And that will post tomorrow. And we'll have his post-UVA career. We'll talk about Brian Stith. We'll talk about obviously American coming back to JPJ and playing Leto. We talk about a photo series, and we touch on Chaminade and Sampson and all of that stuff. The craziness that's happening in the world today. We feel like this is a good break. So stay tuned. Subscribe. Links description in the description. So let us know if you need anything. Enjoy.
Anderson fakes the pass and sends it down with a tomahawk slam. That's the win here. On the front pitch, touch it up and down. Back on the tournament to both. Diakite. Jerome off the glass, count it. And one. Jim Jerome.